I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
America's fascists are those people who think Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
What we've really seen is a financial sector that's gotten out of hand, has much too much of a role in this country.
What Putin is trying to do and what Trump is trying to do is undermine faith in our government.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans.
There's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy that people don't feel that they can do very much.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
The trip in Alice in Wonderland is, of course, through the looking glass, going into a world that is some alternate reality. Unlike Lewis Carroll's fantasy, the world of Donald Trump is real. But it could not be the reality that it is without one key player, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Now, it's easy to see the 73-year-old orange one and for the nation and the world to sit in awe of the audacity and irrelevance of truth by this out-there president. But less visible is his eager enabler, without whom his agenda could not get done. So who is this man behind the throne, this wizard behind the curtain, Mitch McConnell? What motivates the Republican Senate Majority Leader from Kentucky? And what evil deeds carry his fingerprints? Our guest today is Michael Winship. Winship is the Schumann Senior Writing Fellow for the progressive news and commentary website Common Dreams. Good stuff if you haven't checked it out. Previously, he was the Emmy Award-winning senior writer for the Bill Moyers Journal and Moyers & Company TV shows and the website BillMoyers.com. He's past Senior Writing Fellow at the policy and advocacy group Demos, and immediate past president of the Writers Guild of America East. You can follow him on Twitter at Michael Winship. That's it, at Michael Winship. His new article is titled The U.S. Senate of Mitch the Impaler. Thanks for being with us, Michael.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Bert. It's been too long.
Yes, it has. I agree. And not like there's nothing going on to talk about. My goodness. Before we begin, in full disclosure, while vacationing in the sun about 5 years ago, I shook hands with a fellow guest and talked briefly about my run against his Senate colleague, Judd Gregg. I did shake his hand, I will admit. I have since...
Oh, okay. Well, my first encounter with Mitch, not directly, but it was in 1980. I was doing a documentary with Mark Shields for public television about political television advertising.
Oh, wow.
And one of the people we highlighted was a guy named Bob Goodman, who was quite a famous Republican media maker. And Bob had handled the campaign of this guy, Mitch McConnell, who was running for judge in Kentucky against a guy named Hollenbeck. And they produced a really famous commercial that became known as the Horse Sense ad. And it was a farmer mucking out his stable and complaining about the taxes he was paying because of this guy, Hollenbeck, who Mitch was running against. And at the end of the commercial, he sort of threw a shovel full of manure at the camera. And it really caught the attention of a lot of people, and that was Mitch's first election.
Oh, my goodness. Well, catching the imagination of people is... it's so important, and it's so, I think it's harder to do now than it was, 39 years ago? Something like that. Unbelievable.
Yeah, really. No, absolutely. And then, I was just contacted about it by NPR the other day because they've got this, their embedded show is doing some really excellent stuff on McConnell and the tobacco industry and some of the other stuff. So keep an eye out for that, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a lot to talk about Mitch McConnell. He seems to be in the news more and more and more. Now, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell prefers to be thought of as the Grim Reaper. Why does he call himself that? You refer to him as Mitch the Impaler. Why does he like to be called the Grim Reaper?
He likes to be called the Grim Reaper, and he has also called himself Darth Vader because he has vowed to kill any progressive legislation coming out of the Democratic House. And he condemns it all as socialism, and he says that none of it will ever see the light of day, that he will be indeed the Grim Reaper when it comes to progressive legislation. And as there's just a a slew of progressive legislation that is now sort of clogged up in the Senate that has been passed by the House, but Mitch won't let it get by. He won't even let it come up for a vote. So he's living up to his self-dubbed title.
No, he is. But you say the title Mitch the Impaler is more apt description than the Grim Reaper. And in case there are listeners who may not be familiar with the story of Vlad the Impaler, a little history lesson, please. Who was Vlad the Impaler, and how does this living Senate Majority Leader, how can he be compared to Vlad the Impaler?
Well, Vlad the Impaler, some of your listeners will remember, was part of Bram Stoker's inspiration for Dracula.
Right.
And he was a Romanian ruler in the 15th century, and incredibly bloodthirsty, killed tens of thousands of enemies and a lot of innocent women and children as well. And his preferred method of torture and death was impalement, which is just as grim as it sounds. It was a long, it made you suffer long and painfully, and ultimately did the job. But, you know, as I said in the piece that I wrote, there's a lot of this legislation that actually threatens lives, you know. I mean, if it's not passed, it threatens lives. And just among them being the current fracas over the 9/11 emergency responders bill, which he has blocked in the past or held for ransom to get other things in appropriation bills, and shows every sign of trying to block it again. But we'll see what happens. John Stewart's been a very effective and vocal advocate, and once it gets out of the House, which I think it will this week, it's already been passed by the Judiciary Committee. Once it gets out of the House, it'll go to the Senate, and it will be interesting to see how McConnell responds. He's been saying things like, oh, I didn't even realize that was still an issue, and I don't know why John Stewart's is in such a fit about this. I just don't get it, you know, but methinks he doth protest too much.
What would be his motivation? I mean, what could be more popular among the entire, 305 million Americans than, helping the first responders to 9/11? He's pretending it isn't happening, or just wait, be patient. What's his motivation here?
Well, as someone who lives two dozen blocks from Ground Zero, and who was there that terrible morning, I can say how important and necessary this legislation is. And what Mitch has been doing is been allowing it to be renewed in 5-year increments. And then what they're really trying to do now is to get it expanded to a 70-year time limit. And really, basically, it's about him using it because he is this consummate member of Congress, in the sense of using it to manipulate in the name of power and money. He basically has used those people's lives to get other things in these appropriation bills that he wants. They don't have they don't have a lot of the rules that they used to have allowing this kind of thing, but there are ways around it, and he finds them.
Ah, yes, what a swell guy. I mean, I'm going to try to avoid making fun of his resemblance to a turtle. I would never do that. But we have seen a lot of him lately as the 2020 race for president gets underway. And I don't know if the Republican Party has decided itself, the party, to use that used to be scary word socialism, or if he's doing it as, I don't know. He seems to think it's a word Democrats want to run away from. But I'll ask you, Michael, are Democrats trapped, either look bad running from the word socialism or look bad embracing it? What is his thinking? Why does he take such obvious glee in using that word socialism?
Well, I think it's a very old-fashioned view. I think it's a view that, goes back to the 50s and even earlier, when people associated socialism with communism and so forth, and not realizing that, a lot of the New Deal policies and legislation and a lot of the stuff even Eisenhower did could be perceived as socialist. But I think that as a new generation comes along and more of them are voting, they have less they have less association of socialism with things like communism and so forth.
Right.
They're more willing to embrace a lot of the principles, with the idea that we need to help the most people that we can and to do the greater good. I mean, I had to laugh yesterday when he was complaining. I mean, I guess it was on Sunday. He was complaining about the notion of granting statehood to Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia as being full-bore socialism, which is pretty funny. I mean, I think is probably his rationale is those are two parts of the country that are obviously in need of a great deal of help from time to time.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's what he's really worried about is having, you know, four more Democratic senators and however many Congress people they would have in the House, just because, you know, both of those are presumably Democratic strongholds.
Yes. And I guess, as we'll discuss throughout this program, it seems like everything he does is about power and money. Power and money.
I think that's totally correct. Yeah.
So in addition to the people of Kentucky who actually vote for him, what specific interest does he most obviously serve? I mean, there's tobacco, just to get started.
Well, tobacco is an excellent example. Tobacco is something that, being from Kentucky, he, of course, has been a strong advocate for years and years and years. And he has taken an enormous amount of money from the tobacco industry in terms of political contributions and soft money. He also has a McConnell Center at the University of Louisville, which is kind of like his presidential library, except he isn't the president, but it's the equivalent of a presidential library, and the tobacco industry has given well over $1 million toward that operation. But what's interesting now is that he is co-sponsoring this bill to raise the legal age for using tobacco to 21. And there's been a lot of sort of head turning about that, because it just seems not like his character, because this is a guy who fought against eliminating smoking on airplanes, and fought against smoking in federal buildings and things like that. He's always been such an advocate for the tobacco industry, but now he's sponsoring this bill. But a lot of people are saying it's kind of a Jedi mind trick, because Altria and some of these other companies also have very, very strong interests in the vaping industry and e-cigarettes.
Uh-huh.
So that I think they're trying to work into that legislation ways to combat regulations that the government has been trying to put up against vaping. And I think this is kind of a dodge, but a lot of people, you know, American Cancer Society, some of the other groups have endorsed it, but I think a lot of other groups are saying this is just Mitch still really secretly shilling for the tobacco industry.
No, it's clear. It strikes me as a simple, obvious public relations stunt, you know, just, we're responsible. We don't want kids smoking over 21, but as you say, going into the vaping industry, which is
right, and he's sponsoring. I mean, Tim Kaine is the co-sponsor of the bill, and of course,
Virginia
also been a big tobacco state over the years. But
so, what other interest does he do besides tobacco?
This, by the way, because it's such a cash crop in Kentucky, tobacco that Democrats and Republicans, both from the state, have always supported the tobacco industry. But there's some amazing, you know, I mentioned that that NPR embedded investigation. And they've been working with a newspaper in Lexington, Kentucky, and have just gotten hold of an amazing trove of documents that show him allowing himself to be used by the tobacco industry and being given concert tickets and tickets to the theater and other perks. And then you also see the emails within the tobacco industry saying, "Do you feel like you're being choked? Do you feel like Mitch is shaking us down?" You know, and apparently he was.
Yeah. So what other interest does he serve besides the most obvious tobacco of Kentucky?
Well, the one that has come to the fore quite a bit recently, especially due to some investigative work by the New York Times, has been his wife's family's shipping business.
Yes.
This is something that his wife's family owns a company called Foremost, which is a shipping company that has very, very strong ties to China.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got sort of a double whammy with both Elaine Chao and McConnell, because she
and she's Secretary of Transportation.
Part of her job as Secretary of Transportation is regulating the shipping industry. And second, of course, she has been one of the things. Actually, this was something that Politico reported a couple of weeks ago, that she had arranged for $78 million in grants from the DOT to go to Kentucky, and had assigned a staff member specifically to work with McConnell's office to facilitate these grants.
Wow. Is she possibly... There have been questions about Russian money and Russian power. I mean, there's all kinds of rumors as to why Trump, you know, just quivers at the power of Putin. But what about McConnell and his and his wife's relation to Russian money, do you think? I'm not sure about that.
Well, there is a connection. You know, there's been a whole thing with McConnell in terms of he got $3.5 million to his leadership PAC from this Russian-born citizen, Len Blavatnik, who's very close to Deripaska, who's been, you know, very tied up with the whole Mueller investigation and has mentioned quite a lot. And he got those U.S. sanctions lifted. McConnell got those U.S. Sanctions lifted on Deripaska recently, and Deripaska turned around and announced plans to invest $200 million in a new aluminum plant in, guess where, Kentucky.
Okay. Well, but, you know...
The other thing is,
yeah,
somebody pointed out the other day, is that just people forget that there were several congressional campaigns, I think 20 in all, 20 Republican campaigns, in which there was Russian money and Russian involvement in terms of trolling. If there were, there was the money that was put into those campaigns that was laundered, apparently, and that there was trolling on behalf of these candidates, much like they trolled on behalf of Trump.
If you just tuned in, dear listener, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. It's a group effort, it's fellow citizens. Our guest today is Michael Winship, who was a senior writing fellow for the Progressive News and Commentary website, Common Dreams, previously award-winning senior writer for Bill Moyers Journal and Moyers & Company. We're talking about the U.S. Senate of Mitch the Impaler. You know, what many people find baffling is why the formerly sane Republicans continue to kowtow to this unique president. As you write, Democratic presidential wannabe Michael Bennett recently declared Trump is the star of his own three-ring circus in Washington, but there's no doubt who the ringmaster actually is, and that is Mitch McConnell. What is McConnell's relationship with Trump? Why are they, what's going on there?
I think Trump and his people realize that Mitch McConnell is absolutely essential for them to get through their agenda, especially when it comes to the appointment of conservative judges, which they've been very successful at doing, and also other conservative executive appointments. And, you know, the tax cut bill, which was very important to them that they got through. They didn't get the repeal of Obamacare that they wanted, but they've gotten a lot of other stuff. And they need McConnell because he has the professional expertise to know how to play Congress, which is a complicated and
labyrinthine,
very multi-layered organization. He just knows how to pull those strings and play it to its limits.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's able to do that in the face of Democratic opposition that hasn't been very strong, I'm afraid.
Yeah, that's true. Well, at least we have the House for the moment, and the Nancy Pelosi also knows how to work the House system, but you got...
That's very fair. That's a very fair comparison, and Harry Reid was the same.
Yeah, true.
And Chuck Schumer, who is my senator and now the minority leader, has a certain amount of skill in those kinds of things, but not as strong as I wish he would be.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's so much of it has to do with how you how you're perceived on TV. I can't quite figure that out. It bugs the heck out of me. what?
Absolutely.
Well,
even though Mitch on TV is
a wonder
to behold. I think you'll recall that I think it was Gail Collins who said he had all the charisma of an oyster.
There's some great writers out there these days that perks up these troubled times, I must say. Well,
yes.
And you know, sticking with the Russia thing, you know, I've read reports that McConnell got a $200 million investment from a Russian oligarch. I think you said something about that. After he blocked reimposing sanctions. Mm-hmm. Now, and what's he saying now about Congress's continuing investigations into Russian meddling and his position on protecting democracy from further foreign interference?
Every time he is approached about this, his answer, or the answer from his office, is two words, the same two words he used about the Mueller investigation and that Trump uses, case closed. He's just not going to listen to it. He doesn't want to hear about it.
Why?
Well, your guess is as good as mine. I suspect Dread. Those millions of dollars coming in for campaign contributions and whatever other kind of influence is going on are certainly a factor. And the other thing, this is sort of a subtext to all that, is that the other thing he's been working against are these bills to basically reform and change the voting machines, you know?
The two
biggest voting machine companies in the country, their lobbyists have been giving Mitch campaign funds because, you know, he's up for re-election this year. And, you know, so he's been holding that up, too. And, of course, that has an impact in terms of the possibilities of Russian hacking.
Wow. That is disturbing, to say the least. Wow. You know, as Stalin said, it doesn't matter who votes, it's who counts. It doesn't matter who votes that counts, it's who counts the votes that counts.
Right.
Yeah, Stalin, great role model. Now, there are a lot of Republicans in the Senate. They have a majority. Why do the other Republicans go along with this powerful man? What power does he have over them? Why, I mean, it seems like for normally sane, you know, conservative, oftentimes right-wing Republicans, but to go along with Trump?
Well, you know, a Senate majority leader has tremendous power and influence over the other members. You just need to look to Lyndon Johnson, for example, when Johnson was the master of the Senate, as Robert Caro dubbed him, when he was the Senate majority leader. He has an enormous amount of power over his colleagues in terms of distributing funds for re-election, in terms of making sure that they get the, you know, various pork barrel things for their states. He has an enormous amount of influence. He can introduce them to people who have money. He can arrange for them to get influential appointments to various Senate committees and subcommittees that give them greater visibility and greater power. The influence of the majority leader is huge, and so he brings along with that a willingness to help facilitate this desire on the part of conservative Republicans to get these judges into place and get these other executive appointments who are so fiercely deregulatory and so forth, get them into place. And then there's also, of course, he carries also the same thing that he gets from Trump, which is that fear of the base, that elected Trump, has got these guys running and shaking too, because they're afraid that if they challenge Trump, he will encourage someone to primary against them, you know, to run against them. He will bring the power of his social media accounts and whatever else to make fun of them, to come up with a nickname, to trash them, to elevate a primary opponent and support them instead of the incumbent. There's just an enormous amount of power wielded. And I think, you know, it's so interesting about McConnell because he started out in Washington. You know, he was an intern to John Sherman Cooper, who was really one of the giants of the Senate. He was a Republican, but a moderate or to liberal Republican. He was anti-Vietnam. He was he was pro-civil rights and anti-Vietnam.
Wow.
He was a man with an enormous amount of interest in international relations. He was involved in the forming of NATO, and he was always assigned by presidents, Republican and Democrats alike, to take on special envoy diplomatic missions, and he was just this incredible guy, and Mitch was his protege. And in the early days when Mitch was running for judge, and when, you know, the years when he was judge, he wrote an op-ed in favor of campaign finance reform. He was in favor of collective bargaining, things like that. Friends say that he was pro Planned Parenthood, all these things. But once he got into the Senate, you know, those little Scrooge McDuck dollar signs appeared in his eyes, and he became what he has become. I mean, there's a great line, Alan Simpson, the former senator from Wyoming, who was always good for a good for a,
a quote.
One-liner.
Yeah.
He said that Mitch, when he asked for money, his eyes would shine like diamonds. He obviously loved it, he said.
Diamonds are a senator's best friend. Something that
apparently.
Money, yes. Now, you mentioned judicial and executive appointments. It seems like that's McConnell's and the Republicans' overarching motivation. Why is that when it comes to judicial and executive appointments? Why and what interests are driving this effort?
Well, as far as judges go, I mean, the whole bottom line with a judge is that a judge is pretty much forever. A judge is until death, unless there's some egregious wrongdoing on their part that leads to impeachment or expulsion. You appoint a judge, and you've got a judge for maybe 40 years or more, whereas, you know, various politicians and so forth, they're either term limited or they get beat for re-election or they choose not to run again. But a judge essentially is forever. As for the executive appointments, I think it's just a huge thing involving the corporate interests and so forth who want people in those jobs who will keep regulations from increasing and who will knock back the regulations that already exist. So that you have very much, you know, cases of people who come from the very industries they're supposed to regulate, are suddenly put in charge of regulating them, mm-hmm. And it's a really grim prospect.
Grim prospect, and it's like, his wife Elaine Chao is supposed to regulate shipping, and she's profiting from shipping.
And you know, earlier she was the Secretary of the Interior.
I didn't know.
And she was. When Mitch was dealing with the coal industry and so forth, she had a tendency to look the other way on regulations of coal mining, for example.
So the best way to serve his masters, i.e. the big money people, is largely through judicial appointments and fighting against regulations. Interesting stuff. Now, the U.S. Senate, of course, is the upper chamber. If my understanding of history is correct, the original intent was for it to be like a House of Lords, serving the moneyed interest as a check on the rabble of the lower chamber. Senators only became popularly elected in 1913 via the 17th Amendment. So my
they were appointed by the state legislatures.
Yes. So my question is, how unique is someone like McConnell? I mean, is there precedence, for example, of his not secret designs for the new Obama administration? What did he say was the most important thing he set out to do when Obama was first elected? And what about precedence for somebody like him?
He said the most important thing to do, despite all the legislative agenda and all the things that people wanted to take place after Obama was elected, he said that their main objective was to keep Obama a one-term president. I mean, he said that. It was widely reported.
Yep.
And he did it. I mean,
he did? Well, although Obama won.
You know, he, as you recall, I mean, Obama had a terrible time getting his judicial appointments passed by the Senate. He just had a rotten time because McConnell was keeping them bottled up. And, of course, the most flagrant example of that was the Merrick Garland appointment, you know, when Scalia died in 2016, in early 2016, February, McConnell immediately turned around when the president said he wanted to appoint Merrick Garland and said, you know, you can't, we will never approve this. You're not letting the American people speak. The American people have to be allowed to elect a new president in 2016, and only that president can make the appointment, which is, of course, total nonsense.
Yeah. So what?
He had the clout to pull it off.
But oftentimes the law counts, obviously not always, but were there precedents for the maneuver that he did to stop the Senate from even considering Merrick Garland? Was it legal what he did?
No, well, you know, it was legal in the sense that he was able to manipulate the rules of the Senate and get certain rules of the Senate suspended on, you know, filibuster and limits to debate and so forth, and to keep even from, you know, Garland didn't even get a hearing.
Right.
I think they took him around and he had those sort of customary meetings with various senators, but he never actually even got a formal hearing. And it was just because of McConnell's knowledge of how Congress works and the various clout, you know, the various ways he wields his clout, that kept it from happening. Now, has anybody else been like that in the past? I think, you know, as much as I admire much of what Lyndon Johnson did, I think when he was majority leader, he very much wielded that kind of clout. Mm-hmm. And he used it, you know, in good ways and bad ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just as Mitch McConnell has been so in debt to the tobacco industry, Johnson was getting money from the oil and gas industry.
Yeah,
and he was parceling that out to different candidates. And once he had that in his hand, I mean, Cairo talks about this in his biography of Johnson, that his whole attitude changed because he realized the power that he now had, the power of the contribution purse strength. And that was because of the oil and gas industry. And he really was, as Cairo says, a master of the Senate.
Well, now we have a new master of the Senate. We're talking about Mitch McConnell. Our guest today on Keeping Democracy Alive is Michael Winship, who is a senior writing fellow for the progressive news and commentary website Common Dreams and award-winning senior writer for the Bill Moyers Journal and Moyers and Company. And we're talking again about...
And, of course, my boss, Mr. Moyers, was Johnson's press secretary.
That's true.
And acting chief of staff, and was very much involved in the Johnson administration. And I think he would be the first to say that, you know, one of the reasons that Johnson was so successful in the first part of his presidency with the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, Medicare and Medicaid and so forth, was because he knew the Senate.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he knew how the Senate worked. He knew how to manipulate it. He knew how to call somebody like Everett Dirksen, who was the minority leader, and get him to go along on these various things. He was just brilliant at that. And if you ever listen to the Johnson tapes from the Johnson Library that Michael Beschloss has compiled so well, and at least two volumes, I think maybe three now, you see just him talking to these various members of the Senate and brilliantly wheedling and cajoling and browbeating them into submission.
Yes, the treatment, the famous Johnson treatment.
Exactly.
Now, so when Obama was elected in 2008 and became president in 2009, as we mentioned, Mitch McConnell said the only thing is really to stop everything Obama is doing. Has the upper chamber ever been so open about making war on the president who was elected by the entire country? And it seems that, you know, it's one thing to be the opposition, but it's like the Democrats are the enemy, some foreign enemy. So is there precedent for making war on the president who was newly elected?
Well, I would say, you know, I'm not an historian, so I can't really give you every solid precedent, but the one that pops into my head immediately is the radical Republicans against Andrew Johnson.
That's true.
You know, who very much were fighting his presidency. You know, he was a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln had brought in as his running mate in 1864 because he wanted a
Southerner,
a candidate who would theoretically help unify the country once the Civil War was over.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, as we now know, Johnson was as racist and anti-Reconstruction and everything else as many in the South were at the time. He was from Tennessee, and he was just barely kept from
being convicted.
He was impeached, but he was not convicted by the Senate. But that Senate was fiercely, fiercely against the president and fighting against him tooth and nail.
And I wonder, you know, I remember Nixon, of course, when the Republicans stood by their man up into a point. I'm wondering, you know, obviously Mitch McConnell has a tremendous amount of power over the upper chamber.
Right.
I wonder what the point would be where he no longer would have that power. I mean, it would have to look pretty gosh darn bad.
It would
for
have
Trump.
To be pretty bad. You know, one thing that as we said before, one thing that Trump and McConnell have that Nixon didn't have was Fox News and the right-wing media, the talk shows and everything else, who just, you know, blare the party line at all times and protect Trump and protect McConnell no matter what they say and do. I mean, I thought it was interesting that when McConnell was talking about John Stewart over the weekend, it was on, and on Monday, I guess, it was Monday that it happened, he was on Fox and Friends.
Yeah, they have their own network. It's true, their own propaganda.
I think
somehow
something Nixon didn't have, and if Nixon had had it,
Yeah.
He might never have been forced out of office. He might have gotten through that second term.
Yes.
But it was because at the very end, when the Supreme Court ruled that he had to release that smoking gun tape,
right, right,
that showed that he had been aware of the cover-up, that Barry Goldwater and Hugh Scott and a bunch of the other Republicans, they went down Pennsylvania Avenue from the Hill and went mm-hmm. to the White House and said, you've got to go.
Yep, they did. And a big money wasn't with Nixon anymore either at that point.
Right. No, exactly. And Nixon tried to do a lot of the same things that Trump has done toward the end there.
Yes.
Nixon went on very elaborate overseas trips. He went to Egypt, went to various countries, and
yes.
he also had a group, had groups that were sort of backing him up, sort of Tea Party-like groups that were holding rallies and, you know, doing all this kind of stuff. But he just doesn't have the media clout that Trump has.
What a shame. So it's interesting, I think, you know, people get the sense that there's nothing going on in Washington. The Republicans appear to be having success at picturing the Democrats who are focused on investigations, and that's to blame for the logjam, nothing getting done. What is the truth? Can we compare normal levels of roll calls and votes in the Senate under McConnell?
I outlined it in the piece I wrote last week about McConnell. I mean, the amount of, it's sort of remarkable, the amount of legislation that has come out of the House, and it's great stuff. You know, H.R. 1, the For the People Act, which is about campaign finance reform and anti-gerrymandering and automatic voter registration and so forth, and you've got the Equality Act, you've got Paycheck Fairness Act, you've got net neutrality legislation, you've got bolstering Obamacare legislation. There's just a ton of stuff. There's like 100 bills. And also, you know, $15 an hour minimum wage and the Dreamers, you know, the legislation to protect the children of the undocumented who've grown up in the United States. All these things are terrific pieces of legislation. They have actually been very busy. And it just, you know, it hits this, the wall that Trump wants built is not the one across the southern border, it's the one between the House and the Senate.
It's,
you know, a congressman said to me one time, you know, we talk about the enmity between the Democrats and Republicans, he said, but never underestimate the enmity between the House and the Senate.
Well, I've heard the Senate described in the past as the place where good bills go to die.
But it certainly is these days.
And so you've mentioned a few of them that the House has passed, which are just kind of sitting there in the Senate. Important pieces of legislation, which can really affect people's lives, but they're languishing in what you call the Senate mortuary. So you had a whole list of them in the article on Common Dreams. Mm-hmm. What are some of the others that might really affect people's lives for the better?
Oh, you know, Paycheck Fairness Act to fight salary and benefits discrimination against women, Veterans Access to Child Care Act, which increases benefits for veterans for child care, the Climate Action Now Act, which basically gets us back into the Paris Accords. The Consumers First Act, the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. There are about, I think there's 7 or 8 additional bills that would help veterans. And also there's legislation that would restore the parts of the Voting Rights Act that the Supreme Court overruled a few years ago. There's just a lot. Also, gun control, the whole thing about background checks, that's in there too.
Now, it kind of seems like, I mean, all these bills that you just described that could improve people's lives and actually bolster the common good, what a bizarre concept, the common good, I guess, must be socialism, but they in the Senate, the Republican majority in the Senate under McConnell, don't seem to have any fear of voters. I mean, how is it that popular sentiment hasn't caught up with this, that these things that the public wants, that could benefit the public, they just turn their backs on that? Does it, like, have they figured, well, what the public wants doesn't matter anymore?
Well, you know, Bert, I think you've probably seen the same studies that I've seen. There have been several, one of which that stands out in my mind is one that was done that where they sent emails to the staffs and the members of the Senate and the House asking for help on a particular issue, and they sent out one batch where they didn't mention that they were a campaign contributor or a potential contributor, and they sent out another batch where they basically said, "And you know, I'm prepared to give money to the campaign," kind of thing, and they got a much huger, they got a much better response when they mentioned being a contributor or a possible contributor. That's the big thing. It's that damn money. There's just, you know, as has been said too many times, there's just too damn much money in this that keeps them from following the will of the people, and instead has them following the will of corporate interests.
Well, I mean,
and also, just in terms of the makeup of the Senate, you know, you've got a majority, Republican majority, many of whom come from very red states who stand good chances of re-election, who are not as afraid of their re-election prospects. And, you know, again, they're afraid of Trump. And they're afraid of Trump's supporters. And they're afraid of losing them or being primaried. So they're falling right into step with Trump and McConnell.
And, of course, the whole point of all that money is to buy, you know, advertising and get reelected, which it's still about votes. I mean, maybe I'm incredibly naive to think that, you know, we can still vote these guys out of office. Maybe that's just a theory. Maybe it's not reality anymore. Maybe democracy has been that much degraded so that money is just everything. I think there are times when somebody's been way outspent and, you know, the person who's been outspent actually wins.
I think the fear that you express is very real and very valid, but I think, you know, they may have the money, but we have the people, and as has been said. And I think that what we saw in 2018 with the resistance and Indivisible and all the different groups that came together and basically just put, you know, shoe leather on the ground to go around and knock on doors and ring doorbells and solicit opinions and solicit support and solicit small contributions, I think that just has to be goosed into action again for 2020, and I think we're seeing it already. It's diffuse at the moment because, for one thing, there are so many different presidential candidates, but I know for a fact that, you know, people are gearing up to do it again, and that's going to be the way that we take back the Senate, if we're able to take back the Senate. We have an advantage this time. Democrats have an advantage this time that they didn't have 2 years ago, which is that there are only two incumbent Democrats who are up for re-election, who look pretty solid, and everybody can focus their attention on these others and really put their energy into getting Democrats into the seat. So it's going to be interesting.
I always like to hear good news. It's too rare these days.
Oh, I don't give up hope. I think there's a lot of good news, and as I said, we saw in 2018, and it just was amazing. I mean, on every level. I mean, I'm here in New York, where,
well, yeah,
you know, we have this independent Democratic conference, this IDC, and they were conservative Democrats who were primaried, and as a result, we now have a super majority in the state Senate now, and a majority in the state Assembly, where, you know, they're just wrapping up the legislative session in the next day or so, and we've already been able to accomplish a lot. Not everything that everybody wanted, but in terms of progressive legislation, it's done very well. So that gives me hope for the entire country.
What a concept. We can't be naive, that's for sure, but I think, you know, knowing history, we hopefully learn a few things from it. Now, of course, one of my and Bernie Sanders' favorite presidents is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He made serious investments in the nation's infrastructure. I get the impression that is the last time America did anything major about our infrastructure. It is crumbling, and it needs major repairs. Trump even made noise about fixing the infrastructure. Then what happened? What role did our Mitch McConnell play?
Every week is supposed to be infrastructure week.
So what role did McConnell play in?
Doesn't happen.
What role did McConnell play in stopping that?
Well, basically there are two things. I mean, there actually is a Democratic plan for infrastructure, and if you look at the various candidates for president on the Democratic side, there are numerous proposals for infrastructure. But part of the problem is that Trump and the Republicans want it to all be about privatization. They want to subcontract it all out. They want private companies. You know, they want to see the, you know, McDonald's Route 88, and they want to see the, you know, Staples Route 95 and things like that. That's what they want to see happen.
Oh my goodness!
And we know from bitter experience what happens when we allow corporate interests to take over things that are vital to the public welfare.
Yeah, like prisons, things like that. It's not good. It doesn't turn out well. Well, one thing that I find interesting, Trump has promised to veto the rare bipartisan resolution, the one stopping U.S. support for the Saudi war against Yemen. This was very popular. It was bipartisan. What was McConnell's position? Did he at least support, you know, stopping U.S. aid for the Saudi war on Yemen?
He supported it, but with the knowledge that they didn't have the votes to override Trump's veto.
Playing.
And you see that happen a lot. You'll see that happen a lot where a senator or a congressman will voice their support outwardly for something, knowing full well that either it won't pass or it'll get vetoed, so that on paper or, you know, in the public record at least, they could look like they were for it when actually they're against it.
So
that has happened. You know, that's, as you say, that's one of the few bipartisan things that have gotten through, that and the disaster relief and the bills to get the government back on track after we had the shutdown.
All right. Well, he can easily play both sides. I mean, that's an old maneuver. It happens in state legislatures all over the place. Bert Cohen here. We are keeping democracy live with your help, dear listener. Our guest today, Michael Winship, who has worked a lot with Bill Moyers and is currently a senior writing fellow for the progressive news and commentary website Common Dreams, which you should check out. And we're discussing the U.S. Senate of Mitch the Impaler. Now, what about election security? I would think people care about this.
I mean, oh, sure.
The kerfuffle over Trump saying, "Yeah, sure, let them participate in our elections, no problem." What's his approach to Russian meddling in our democracy? Is he like openly saying, "I'll let Russia meddle in our democracy"?
Well, no, he's not saying that openly, but all his actions are resulting in exactly that. I mean, you'll remember what happened in 2016. There was a meeting with the joint leadership of the House and Senate with the Obama administration, and they basically had to, they gave them the intelligence briefing and told them that the Russians were indeed actively meddling in the election, and Obama wanted to go public with it and tell the nation what was going on. And Mitch's reaction to that was, "No, if you do that, I'll say that you're doing it for partisan purposes, and I'll make it a huge campaign issue." And the Obama White House backed down, which, you know, with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, they shouldn't have done, obviously. But they were pretty sure that Hillary Clinton was going to win, and B, they were just concerned about it becoming a big partisan issue suddenly, when it really wasn't at all.
And I'm sure Nixon wishes he could have had a Mitch McConnell on his side.
Yes. Nixon did not have the advantage of a Republican Senate, for one thing. I mentioned Dirksen before. I mean, there was certainly a much more of a bipartisan spirit in those days. And it was easier to get both parties to cooperate on legislation. But Nixon could have used somebody like that. But he did, you know, as you said before, right up until the very end, a lot of those people still stayed with him until it was just longer
possibly
tenable. That was actually my first TV job in Washington, was working on the public television coverage of the House Impeachment Committee hearings.
Oh, fun.
In 1974. And there were a number of those Republicans, you know, who held out until the very end. The articles were passed, the three articles. There were actually six. The House passed three of them, the Judiciary Committee. And they were preparing for the vote in the House and then a Senate trial before Nixon resigned. But, yeah, it, you know.
A lot of the Republicans were very pained. You could see it on their faces, as I recall.
Oh, yeah, no question.
Well, on the subject of the I word, as I almost call him Nixon, as Trump likes to refer to impeachment, I wonder, again, maybe I'm naive, if the House has an impeachment inquiry and they find enough real stuff. I mean, Mitch has said very dutifully, case closed, case closed, case closed, like no collusion, no collusion. You know, just case closed, just shut it down, nothing to it. But I wonder what your thoughts might be. If there's like really substantial evidence, as there seemed to be in the Mueller report that came out in an impeachment inquiry, would Mitch... I wonder if it's possible that there could be enough real stuff of concern to the American public that even Mitch McConnell would have to back down. Or is it just plain impossible no matter what? What do you think?
I think under the circumstances, it would be very, very hard. It would have to be something so colossally, monumentally illegal that... For them to get the votes they need in the Senate for a conviction. I personally don't think that's going to happen, but this is not to say that there should not be an impeachment. An impeachment brings a lot to the table in the sense that it consolidates the investigations into one major investigation. It creates a vehicle for the story to be told forthrightly. It creates a forum whereby people who haven't read the Mueller report, or who may not be aware of anything that's in the Mueller report, would have it laid out for them beautifully in a series of public hearings. You know, people don't remember this, but I was working on it, and I remember is that the Judiciary Committee convened in the spring of 74 to consider the impeachment of Nixon, and then were behind closed doors for months. They didn't come back out in public until July.
Oh, interesting.
And then basically held a series of public meetings and sessions that resulted ultimately in the voting of the three articles of impeachment. But I think that having an impeachment, I mean, I've gone back and forth on this
sure.
a lot, but
yeah, there's a lot
I basically
to it.
Fall down on the side of we should definitely go forward with an impeachment inquiry. And whether or not that's going to have an impact on the 2020 elections, I don't believe it necessarily has a bad impact on the 2020 elections, as long as the Democrats make sure people are aware that they've got a lot of other pieces of legislation, a lot of other programs, things that they can propose. I mean, this is where I think Elizabeth Warren has been so strong, is that she's been able to say, I'm for impeachment. I want impeachment. But let me tell you something. I've got a program about this. I've got a program about health care. I've got a program about education.
Yeah.
I've got a program about immigration. She has that documentation. And as long as the Democrats are able to make that case, I think they can go ahead with impeachment.
Oh, interesting. And, you know, obviously... The Trump administration, I'm not sure they even know the difference between truth and lies. It doesn't seem to matter. But they've been able to make it stick that the Democrats are focused on impeachment, you know, and that's why they're not getting things done. And I think you're right about, you know, if Democrats can say this is... Go ahead.
Just in the last couple of days, Katie Porter, the congresswoman from California, who's a freshman, who came in with the 2018... Blue Wave. She came out for impeachment in the last couple of days. She's a very forthright, very scholarly, very skilled member who's proven herself in a variety of hearings already. But she came out in the town hall in favor of impeachment over the weekend.
Mm.
And she has, I recommend to your listeners, she has put out a 9-page paper on impeachment with footnotes that you can download from her website. And it is a very concise and very good summary of what impeachment does, what it means, how you go about it. And I urge people to read it.
You can tell you live in New York City. I hear the sirens in the background. But
you have to speak up a little bit because I've got the...
Right. The sirens in the background. I can hear you're in New York City. Well, it does seem that everything Mitch McConnell does is filtered through the lens of, will it benefit me politically? That I wonder how common that is. I'm guessing it's pretty common, but I don't know. Is it a different level with McConnell?
You know what? I need you to repeat that because the noise was so loud.
It seems that everything Mitch McConnell does is filtered through the lens of the question of, will it benefit me politically? How common or uncommon is that, do you think?
Oh, I think it's very common. I think, sadly, it's very common. It's all about self-interest too much.
Yeah.
I mean, there are members of Congress, there are members of the House and members of the Senate who are there for the common good, who are there to help either follow the will of the people or to guide the will of the people to a proper place. I think there are tons of members who do that. But unfortunately, you know, that re-election thing happens every 2 years if you're in the House, right. Every 6 years if you're in the Senate, and you just have to constantly focus on fundraising.
Yeah, totally.
You've seen the same things I have seen about the number of hours both Democrats and Republicans are told they're supposed to devote on any given day just working the phones.
That's what they got to do. It's a messy system. We have to deal with that somehow. Well, just before we end the show, obviously, it's very clear, Trump stands for election in 2020, but the Senate, as you just said, is staggered six-year terms, and there's only two Democrats who are up, which is a great thing, so we can focus on getting Republicans out. What's happening in Kentucky, Mitch McConnell's home state? Is there a Democrat poised to run and raise the big bucks needed? Could Kentucky save America from McConnell?
There are a couple of people who have been approached to run against him. There is a veteran who Schumer has been talking to, and there is also a guy who's a radio host, like yourself, who apparently is very popular and very outspoken in Kentucky. And I think he may be inclined to run. I'm not sure about the vet, and I apologize for not having their names at the tip of my tongue. But yeah, it's hard. It's hard to find people to run against McConnell just because he is so powerful and because he has brought so much business into the state that people like. You know, he has a long record of opposing something like health care on a national level, but then he'll go into Kentucky and get bills passed that favor Kentucky, that provide free health care for the indigent and things like that. I mean, he works it both ways. He'll ply the national party line on things like health care, and then he'll turn around and very specifically have programs that actually benefit his own constituents. So he plays that in a very wily way as well.
Well, he is certainly wily. Thank you so much. Very interesting. We'll have to talk to you again relatively soon. As always, things
that
coming up.
That would be nice.
And if you're interested in, dear listener, in following Michael Winship, Twitter handle at Michael Winship, and of course, commondreams.org. Thanks so much for being with us.
And I urge people to look at Common Dreams. It's a great website.
Yeah, it really is. And thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Mitch McConnell does remind me of kind of a creepy spider. So here is The Who.
Look who's crawling up my wall. Black and hairy, very small. Now he's up above my head, hanging by a little thread.
In the ground, what is this?
he's embedded in the ground. Ah, may it work that way for Mitch McConnell.